Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Investments. Complicated? Not when you talk to a financial broker about a Zurich investment plan.
And as we've been hearing, the former SDLP leader and Nobel laureate John Hume has died aged 83. Joining me now for further tribute and memory, journalist Eamon Malley and ex-Irish ambassador Bobby McDonough. Thank you both for joining me, gentlemen. Eamon, to you first, you're probably the best placed person to answer this question as something of a, at this stage, it feels like an ever-present commentator in Northern Ireland. Many had to take risks in arriving at the Good Friday Agreement. But was he the architect? I mean, he was the man who went to Adams, broke that cycle of exclusion, cultivated the US leaders, persuaded Clinton to back it, persuaded British prime ministers that it was doable, kept Irish politicians on the straight and narrow. Is this his achievement?
Yes. Rarely has one human being made such a difference. In fact, I was just thinking today, the appropriate phrase, if ever was appropriate for any individual and contribution that individual made, was "e pluribus unum." Out of many comes one, and he was the one. He was the chosen one who had the vision and who had the tenacity and the commitment and the courage. And he needed all of those because he was dealing with people who were wedded to violence. He was dealing with a very intransigent British government for many of the years in which he was involved in politics. And then, even when he was at the point of delivering the big prize, in essence, he was dumped by the British and the Irish governments on the grounds that they believed only governments could realise agreements. But Hume had done the heavy lifting in terms of his negotiations and discussions for so long, almost 10 years, with Gerry Adams, but at the Brussels summit, Albert Reynolds and John Major literally saw him off the pitch, saying that the governments would do the deal. And there's a certain little bit of disingenuous revisionism at play in claiming that there was nothing there when Albert Reynolds came into play. Hume and Adams and all of that, they were already well into it and they were drafting papers. In fact, John Hume used to invite me up to Donegal, and he would ask me to go into a room, and on the table there would be various papers, and this was what was called an iterative process. He'd meet Adams, and he'd put propositions, and Adams then would come back with further propositions. That's the way it went. That was going on practically from about 87 onwards, and then of course it broke as public news in 1993. When somebody told Eamon McCann about witnessing Gerry Adams going into John Hume's house at the Bog side. But John had done all the spade work, and that was the essence of the Good Friday Agreement at the end of the day.
The chosen one, you say, which is really interesting when you consider how humble his origins were, and it was in a kind of a almost reminiscent of that Monty Python sketch, "What have the British ever done for us?" It was education that lifted him out of poverty, education by the UK government.
Well, as education did for so many of us. I remember a British minister saying, what a waste of money it was, all that money wasted on Bernard Devlin being educated. What an insulting comment. But, you know, John Hume's background is very interesting. His great-grandfather was a Scottish Presbyterian immigrant to Donegal, and he really learned his politics at his father's tea table, because the father regularly, habitually, in the evening when John was doing his homework at the other end of the table, he told me this himself, was filling in forms, or as some people say, filling out forms for poor people who were trying to apply for grants or support or dole and that type of thing. So John learned his socialism sitting at the table with his father at tea time. His father filled out forms because his father had that type of zeal as well and dedication to attention. And it was during a protest in Derry that the father observed what was going on, said to John, listen, son, he said, don't get involved in any of this, he said. And remember one thing, you can't eat a flag. And that became a cornerstone of John's philosophy, all of you cannot eat a flag.
Ex-Irish Ambassador Bobby McDonagh also with us. While Eamon says it's absolutely right, he was very much focused in his early career on local politics, national politics, bread and butter kind of issues. He was also very far ahead, wasn't he, of many of the other inward-looking provincial kind of politicians in Northern Ireland, because, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think the first visit to the United States came as early as 1969 when he went to Boston to start forming those absolutely crucial alliances, Bobby.
You're right, Philip. John Hume was a major figure on three different stages. I mean, obviously at home in Northern Ireland and across these islands, he was probably the most significant figure in bringing peace and progress over the past 50 years. But he also was a major figure in the United States, and in particular with Irish America and Teddy Kennedy and the other leading Irish American politicians, and then later with Bill Clinton. And thirdly, in the European Union. I mean, he was the only MEP from the SDLP, but he had immense stature and wielded immense influence. And you know, in recent years, we've seen the way the European Union has stood by Ireland in relation to Brexit. But John Hume was the person who put Europe, who put Northern Ireland on the European agenda when he was a member of the European Parliament. And on top of those three stages in which he was a major figure, he was also, of course, a huge person in global terms. He won the Nobel Peace Prize with David Trimble, and he won the Gandhi Peace Prize and the Martin Luther King Award. So he was a remarkable Irishman.
Is it your impression that there was always a long-term strategy there in forming those alliances in the United States, building those friendships in Brussels, that ultimately the main prize was, in his mind, I can outflank the British government, I can push them from a bully pulpit to the negotiating table if I make these friendships, Bobby?
I think there was always a strategy there, because I think apart from John Hume's remarkable personality and his principle as a man of peace, he had a great intellect. He had a brilliant mind. And I think, you know, his great wisdom was always expressed in very simple insights. And some young people today, many might not think that the sort of things John Hume said were anything remarkable. But at the time, they were simple things like that: when people are divided, the only solution is agreement. And that we must respect different allegiances, and perhaps above all, that the only unity worth having on this island is a unity of people and not of territory. So these things resonate across our history, and they also still shape who we are today. And I think that was John Hume's strategy, to modernise our approach to the issues in Northern Ireland and try to bring peace. But having said that, he always had a strategy. He was willing to change his strategy, and that's the sign of a great mind as well. I mean, for many years, the attempt of everybody, you know, the two governments and John Hume and so on, was to exclude the people who were involved in violence. But John Hume saw that that wasn't working. And so he had the courage to try a new approach and to start a new process, the Hume-Adams talks. And that took great courage. So, yes, he had a strategy, but he was quite capable of adapting it in order to achieve his goal of peace.
Would you agree, Eamon, amongst those scraps of paper that you saw on the table in the holiday home in Gweedore, was there one marked grand plan, and was that it?
Oh, yeah. He was always ahead of the game. He was extraordinary. And I think one of the big changing points in his life was when he got to know Peter Brook. Peter Brook, the Secretary of State, who became rather damaged as a result of his singing "Oh My Darling Clementine" on the Late Late Show. But Peter and John Hume, there was a meeting of minds there, and Hume persuaded Peter Brook to make that famous remark about the British of Britain having no selfish strategic interest, economic interest in remaining on this island. And that was a seminal moment in the mind of Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness. And Peter Brook had said some interesting things 100 days into office as Secretary of State in Northern Ireland, when he said he was thinking and wouldn't rule out the possibility of talks with Sinn Féin at some time, but he did set the condition there that there would have to be a ceasefire. But he opened the door, and Hume, and he almost, it was a confluence of views, a conflation of views somewhat, because they realised, they perceived that Republicans were misrepresenting British presence. And once Peter Brook made that famous statement, it was the Whitbread Statement from Westminster. It had a huge impact on people like Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams. And really, that was the door opener to the real change that came about in Republicanism.
Eamon, as a Cub reporter, I remember being quite frustrated reporting from Castle Buildings when you would try and get John Hume to comment on the latest pronouncements of whoever else was party to the negotiations in 1998 and in 99 and 2000 and further on. And he would never do that. He always delivered the single transferable interview. He refused to be drawn on today or tomorrow or yesterday's controversy. And it was only listening to your podcast relatively recently with Mark Durkin that I realised it was a strategy. Never react to the reaction.
Correct. What a phrase. Never react reaction. Of course, Hume was a master strategist. And it's an interesting thing. Bobby was talking there about his commitment to Europe. He's been ill for quite a long time, and he's been in that care home in his native city for quite a long time. But I suppose the last political intervention he made or comment he made was...
Oh, dear. Eamon, start that again. We lost you there. Start again. The last political intervention he made was?
I suspect this was his last political statement or intervention. He was, of course, very ill, and he was in the care home in his native city in Derry. And Mark Durkin and Jackie and Pat were in visiting him, and there may be some other members of the family. This was pre-COVID-19. So anyhow, they were standing around the bed in his room, and they were talking about Brexit and Boris and the implications. And at this stage, John had been dozing off. And he came to himself, and he shook himself, and he said, "What were you saying? What were you saying there?" And Mark or somebody said, "Oh, we were just talking about Brexit." He says, "Oh," he says, "Conservatives and Brexit?" He said, "Why are they getting into that? What are they doing? Why are they bothering with that?" That was probably his last political observation. According to Mark Durkin, who has got such a brilliant recall of these moments. I should also say, I was talking with Pat on Friday. I just called
Pat
her to
Hume.
See how everybody was. Pat Hume, yes. And, we discussed that critical moment at Grace Dean when the relative of one of the people who was shot dead in Grace Dean thanked John for all his efforts.
This is when John visibly broke down at the funerals of those who had been killed
right.
at Grace Dean, and one of the daughters came up to him and said,
right.
"Keep the course."
Yeah. And she said to him, "We prayed around my father's coffin or my member of my family's coffin for you, John," and he broke down. That was an extraordinary moment. Now, I didn't know this until going back to revisit Miriam O'Callaghan's interview some years back. And Pat informed Miriam O'Callaghan that she asked John at the time about the whole wisdom of continuing to talk to Gerry Adams. And I raised this with her the other day. And she said, "Yes, I did. I asked them after Grace Dean because of all the pressure. We were under so much pressure from so many quarters that I said to him, would you not rethink your talks with Gerry Adams?" He said, "Sure," this is the exact quote, "I have started and I will continue." She said he didn't give it a second thought. "He could see the big picture," she said. "I can only see small pictures."
Mm. John Hume staying the course.
Pat is not a woman. Pat is not a woman who sees small pictures. But she said that was, he had started and he would finish. And on the 18th of August, at an SDLP meeting, he was mauled at that meeting because 1994, 12, 13 days before the IRA ceasefire, he was mauled by his colleagues at a party meeting on the Lisbon Road in the headquarters. And somebody said to him, "John, you're killing the party." And he lifted his head and he said, "You're telling me I'm killing the party. And there are people being killed on that street every day," he said. "If I'm wrong, I'll apologize, but I will not apologize for trying to stop the killing." And going home that evening in the car with Mark Durkin, he was saying, "I'll quit. I'm going to quit." And Durkin said, "Ah, stop talking like that," because Mark knew the next morning Pat and John were going to Dublin, and that Pat would sort all things out in the course of the visit to Dublin or the journey to Dublin. And, of course, John did not quit at that stage.
John Hume started and finished at the age of 83 on the 3rd of August 2020. Eamon Malley and Bobby McDonough, thank you both very much.